Hey, Sydney.
Hey, Samuel.
I was really lucky recently, and I was able to visit the site of an old architectural installation from a World's Fair, and it's really inspired me to like start writing poetry and like have a lot more hope for the future of humanity, generally speaking.
Yeah. That's really cool. Did you go to like the Crystal Palace or Eiffel Tower? Which one was it?
Oh, no, it was actually the Knoxville Sun Sphere. Let's go Vols, baby. Go Vols.
Go Vols. No, did you know I have a bone to pick with the Sun Sphere because it's now $10 to go to the top of it. It used to be free. And I'm like, all right.
Who do they think they are?
It's the Sun Sphere. Like,
a wig warehouse? What are we doing here?
I'm glad you're here. I'm going to get right into the message. I'm going to tell it like it is, as they say. Uh-huh. Oh, I heard a hallelujah. Did you think I don't know what the hell is going on? And a lot of strange places. Where in the hell have you been? Hellfire. All right. Okay, there's something else, too.
Hello and welcome to the Satire Fire, your number one podcast reporting from the hole underground that we're just poking our heads out in order to send this to you. I'm Samuel.
I'm Sydney.
And this week we are starting a brand new series on the 1864 novella Notes from the Underground by Fyodor Dostoevsky. If you're not familiar with our podcast, we are a podcast all about satire, mainly satirical books, where each week we're going to take a satirical book and discuss it. Each of those books, we're going to take about 3 weeks to talk about them, 1 week to do a plot synopsis, 1 week to talk about the history of the book and the context that you might need in order to understand it. And then 1 week for us to analyze the book, say if we liked it or not, say if it's still relevant today as far as what critiques it's making and what kind of points it's trying to make. So this being the first part of our Notes from Underground series, we're going to be going into the plot of the book. So if you haven't read it, first off, go and read it. It's really short. It's a little novella. It's only like 200 pages or so. So it's not like too much to read. But if you haven't read it and you don't want to read it, that's okay. We'll explain it all here so that you're all caught up and ready to learn with us. Because next week's going to be a big week. There's a lot of context that goes into such a tiny little book. It turns out that it's not intuitive what exactly was going on in 1860s Russia.
Oh, really?
But before we get into all of that and I start alluding to some of the things that we're going to be learning about next week.
Is this our... No, never mind. Jane Austen is older still. Never mind.
Jane Austen is older. I was thinking about this last week. This is our second oldest book, but Jane Austen came out about 40 years before this one, or 40 or 50 years. But before we get too much further, Sydney, do you have anything else that has been going on, anything that you've read or watched or thought about recently that you want to tell the good people about?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about a satirical musical that I went to recently.
Okay.
So it wasn't on Broadway. I'm currently in reporting live from Knoxville, Tennessee, home of the Sun Sphere. I've been in Knoxville, and they had a traveling Broadway cast of The Book of Mormon, which is highly satirical. That's fun. I was like, you know, we've never really talked about a satirical like play or musical, and that might be something to keep on our radar for
we
the
should.
Future for an interlude, but yeah.
Or as a full series. You can read a play.
That's true. You can read a play. Did you guys know? One of my favorite plays, and then therefore musical, it's not my favorite musical, but there's a musical based on it, is Pygmalion, which was turned into My Fair Lady, mm-hmm. Which has some satirical elements, so, but I don't know. Anyways, but yeah, I went to see the Book of Mormon, and for those of you who, like, aren't super aware of what goes on in the world of Broadway, so you have musicals and plays that are on Broadway, which just means that they're performed in New York City at a Broadway theater. They have a residency on Broadway. And then there are casts that are, like, affiliated with Broadway that travel the country and perform in theaters around the United States. And so you can see a Broadway play or musical at your local theater sometimes, but that doesn't mean you're seeing a play on Broadway. Kind of confusing, but whatever.
Yeah, you're seeing a play that was on Broadway with a Broadway cast, but you're not seeing a play on Broadway because, spoiler alert, folks, Broadway is not in Knoxville, Tennessee.
But that being said, it was great. It's hilarious, as expected. It is quite offensive. So if you don't like that kind of thing, if you don't like offensive humor, maybe don't go see it. But also, if you don't really like offensive humor, satire just might not be your jam. So
yeah,
sometimes
that's fair.
Satire, it's not always offensive. And for me, I like when things are intelligently offensive, like if they're clever, they're well-researched, and they're not, like, punching down.
Yeah.
As opposed to ignorant offensiveness. That isn't funny. So
yeah, there's a huge difference between saying something that would offend the head of Scientology versus saying something that would offend your trans best friend or any woman in your life. Like, those are different things.
But it was really good. It was really funny. I liked the music because it had a lot of just, it pulled from a lot of different styles of music to influence the songs that were happening. Brief summary of the plot of the Book of Mormon for anyone who's interested in seeing it and, like, wants to know a little bit more. Basically, it's making fun of Mormonism, so start there and decide whether you're okay with that. Then
if you're not okay with that, maybe don't listen to the podcast.
But basically, these two boys who have just turned 19, and they're going on their mission, which is something that's traditional for boys and who are Mormon, and you're sent somewhere in the world with your mission partner. So you and another guy go somewhere to spread the Book of Mormon, spread the gospel of the Mormon, the Church of Latter-day Saints. Anyways, these two boys get sent to Uganda, and they're sent to a village that is experiencing a lot of hardship. AIDS, poverty, food insecurity, there's bugs that kill you. Like, and then there's a militia, a local militia that is led by a guy who's actually a real person in history, General Butt Naked, which is, you know, he was a terrible person. He mutilated women. He said he was, like, a prophet and was told by God to do that. Anyways, it's based in some reality of, like, things that have actually happened. And so they go to this village, and they're finding it hard to reach these people because these people don't trust them. And that's the inciting incident, basically. And I'm not going to say the rest of the plot. But I thought it was fantastic. So I would recommend it. They're traveling right now, so if they come to your city and you're interested, you should go see it.
Definitely. Great shout. It's one of those musicals that I know a fair amount about just as a cultural touchstone, but I've never seen it. I have never, like, really engaged with it. I think I can... It's one of those few musicals... Actually, maybe it's not that few now that I think about it. Being a nerdy Tumblr kid growing up, I feel like there's a list of musicals that I can quote that I've never actually seen, and that's definitely on that list.
Yeah, it's also by partly written, or two of the writers for it were the writers of South Park, or were writers for South Park. So if you like South Park, the humor is very similar. So, yeah.
Awesome.
What about you? What have you been reading or watching?
So, I've decided to put my frickin' foot down, folks. I'm taking a stand. I found a hill and I'm gonna die on it. I have started reading a lot more short form fiction, and specifically am trying to go out of my way to read more short fiction in like literary reviews. So specifically, I've been reading a fair amount of stuff that's coming from the Suwannee Review, which is a somewhat, I mean, I say somewhat, it's a very prestigious literary review that features like poetry and nonfiction and fiction writing, all like relatively short form. I say it's relatively prestigious because it's not like the New Yorker, but it's still a literary review that I personally will never be accepted into because it's very competitive and very well regarded. But part of my like feelings about this and the reason why I'm getting into it is because, first of all, I think that any time in the current landscape that I'm able to interact with and support something that is a form of physical journalism, I'm really interested in that. Like, I really don't enjoy the fact that the majority of journalism is kind of shifted into this online landscape that is, like, fine, but I think that sometimes online-forward journalistic entities sometimes prioritize just clicks and views more than the content that they're putting in. That's not the case for everything. There's obviously going to be exceptions to that, but that's just generally kind of how I feel. And also, I really like taking the opportunity to be able to support what I kind of consider to be the vanishing middle class of writers, where I feel like for a long time, like through the 80s, 70s, even in the early 2000s, there were a lot of people who were able to make not like a stupid amount of money, but a living through writing. Either it'd be like journalistic pieces or short form fiction, like whatever it might be. There was a whole class of people that were able to make a living off of that and not necessarily have to make a killing off of it, where it's become more the case that either you're a have or a have not in those industries. Like, either you're a Brandon Sanderson and you actually get your books published and you get to publish 5 books a year, or you can't get a foothold into the industry and you're just kind of like scraping through, doing the best that you can. And I think that that's something that's gotten a lot worse even in the past year or so. Like, I just recently saw an analysis that was talking about the impact that the introduction of AI has had on jobs. And like, across the board in all industries, job postings are down 8% from what they were 2 years ago, but specifically writing jobs are down like 30%, and like journalism jobs are down 20%. Like, all of these jobs are just like not existing anymore in a way that they have always existed. And so this is my call to action for folks for this episode, as well as my own personal call to action. Support the things that you enjoy. And I enjoy reading things that are not slop, and I enjoy being able to support people writing stuff that is not slop. And so one way that I can do that, and that I found to do that, is reading local newspapers and picking up and reading literary reviews and stuff like that. And it's been a really fun and pleasant addition into my reading repertoire that I would highly recommend for anyone else out there. Whatever you can do.
Yeah, that's also on that note. That was an excellent note. And as a journalist and writer, I really appreciate that. And I also think for you listeners out there, if you have any friends that are journalists or writers, check in on them. Especially if you have any unemployed journalist or writer friends, check in on them. It's tough out there.
Yeah, it's not. Not to say that it was ever really good out there, but it's definitely worse than it has been for quite some time.
Yeah. No, I have a mentor who's just a more senior person in the field.
Cannot believe you called her old like that.
And she she's just been in journalism for a long time, and like if you think of like an old journalism movie and you think of like what the reporters in those movies are like, that's how she acts.
Constantly smoking, cup of coffee, talking about the beat.
Yeah, but she said to me recently, this is the worst she's ever seen the job market for journalism in her time in the field, and that she would be surprised if I could get a job within the next year even. Yeah. Which, like, but yeah, it's she, I mean, that's someone speaking from experience of just like moving from job to job and such for however many years she's been doing it, a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it is in a worse place than it has been before. A lot of fields are not what they were.
Yeah, I was about to say it feels like that's kind of a common through thread. I just had someone recently talking with me who's been in my field since the 80s. And he said, it's the worst that it's ever been. I don't know how it could get any worse than it currently is. Like, that's so awesome to hear as you are retiring and I am starting my career.
Anyways.
With all that out of the way, if any of that information made you feel like you would like to crawl into a hole underground and just write furiously with no purpose in mind, then do I have the book for you? Let's start talking about Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. So, like I said, this is a novella. It's relatively short, and it is maybe one of the most direct and cutting satires that we've read on the show so far, with the little asterisks on it of what he is satirizing is so period specific that a lot of it can be missed pretty easily. So I'm going to talk about it. Like I said, this is just a plot summary episode. I'm going to talk in broad strokes about what the plot is. But you're probably going to want to have to come back next week in order to hear all the context for this, in order to like really appreciate what makes this book not just a good book, but a really great book and a great satire. So the novella is broken into two sections. The first part is just called Underground. It is set in the 1860s. And the second part is called Apropos of the Wet Snow. And it is set in the 1840s. Both parts are taking place in St. Petersburg. They're both being told from the same narrator. It's basically a man starts writing how he is feeling about his life during modern day, quote-unquote modern day, 1860s Russia. And then after talking about that for a while, he then starts to reminisce about what his life was like in the 1840s. And so that's the through line between it. And it's really an examination of the narrator, looking at his feelings about the world and why it is that he ended up being underground, with part one mainly looking at what he believes and part two being this is a snapshot of what my life was like before I was underground. So part one is really dense in theory and philosophy and not a lot of plot. So I'm going to do my best to summarize it, but not much happens for the first third of the book because it's just kind of him waxing poetic about how great he is and how awful everyone else is. The story starts with one of the most famous opening lines in literary history. I am a sick man. I am a wicked man. Which really starts you off strong of this guy has a lot of internalized self-loathing that we're going to start unpacking through the course of this. He talks about how he used to be a civil servant, recently retired due to some inheritance, but when he was a civil servant, he was intentionally bad at his job. He was rude and unhelpful, but he was never actually a wicked person or a scoundrel because he couldn't commit hard enough to being bad at his job. Which leads us to learning that a lot of the decisions that he has made in his life have been based on spite. So, like, his liver hurts, but he refuses to see a doctor out of spite. The weather is bad in St. Petersburg, but he refuses to move for his health because of spite. There's, like, a lot of conflicting emotions within him that kind of drive him into not doing anything. So, like, he feels like he's a wicked person, but also he's sentimental. He hates himself, but he also despises other people. All of this stuff is really pushing him into being a very, very internalized person who finds himself to be very lonely all of the time.
I feel like this guy's like the original overthinker. I'm like,
he's the original overthinker. He's also, we'll get into it, the original incel. He's the OG lots of stuff. We get a note early on from Dostoevsky about both the book and the character, which I'm gonna send to you, Sydney, so you can read.
It says, both the author of the notes and the notes themselves are, of course, fictional. Nevertheless, such persons as the writer of such notes not only may but even must exist in our society, taking into consideration the circumstances under which our society has generally been formed. I wish to bring before the face of the public a bit more conspicuously than usual one of the characters of a time recently past. He is one representative of a generation that is still living out its life.
So we're getting
guys like this do exist.
We're getting into straw man arguments really early on of Dostoevsky saying, listen, this guy doesn't exist, but if he did, oh my god, I would hate him so bad. We quickly learned from the guys talking that he is relatively well-read / well-educated because he's making a lot of references to philosophers and books and stuff like that along the way that really pushed the concept that this dude spent a lot of time studying early in his life, and maybe that's all he's ever done is study instead of doing things. His first bone that he picks is the concept of consciousness, where he talks about how he himself operates on a higher level of consciousness than basically everybody else in society. Mm-hmm. But his overactive conscience has led him not just to appreciate, quote, everything beautiful and lofty, which is a recurring phrase throughout the book, the idea of things being beautiful and lofty, but he also is able to find a twisted pleasure in suffering. So, like, just because things are bad doesn't mean that they're unenjoyable because he has such a high degree of consciousness that he's able to wallow in self-pity, basically.
He's like your, like, brief artist boyfriend who moves in but doesn't pay rent and doesn't buy himself food. And it's like, no, babe, like, I've got just, there's so much going on in here. Like, I can't deal without there.
so true. And if you are that artist boyfriend, we see you. He has come to the conclusion that it's impossible for him to change his nature, which makes him feel more satisfied in the fact that his nature sucks so bad. But at the same time, he also thinks that everything that happens to him is his own fault because he's too smart. And he's like so smart compared to everyone else that everything must be his fault, because if he didn't want it, then he could have been too smart and avoided it. Again, we're getting into contradictory natures where he's proud of how smart he is, but he's ashamed of how smart he is. This is like a really big theme throughout of like conflicting emotions that Dostoevsky's trying to make a point on. He goes further into what he views as the differences between himself and the common man when it comes to consciousness, where basically he claims that your average person has such a low degree of consciousness that if they are insulted, they will instantly seek revenge because revenge would be a form of justice. But on the other hand, he is so enlightened and sees things in such a nuanced manner that he would be unable to act after being insulted and would just kind of wallow in it. It has such gross energy of like, oh, why I oughta.
He's an empath.
Yes, exactly. He's such an empath that he refuses to stand up for himself or leave his hole in the ground.
Mm-hmm. It's just so hard. Thinking so much.
He talks more about the idea of being able to find pleasure in suffering. He uses a metaphor of a toothache where he's like, yeah, the pain of a toothache is awful, but it also brings you pleasure because it allows you to complain about how much pain you're currently in. And we all love annoying our loved ones by talking about how bad our tooth hurts.
He's also just like, I remember in that scene, he was like imagining it playing out, like him complaining and being in agony and his family being annoyed. And then he imagines there's like an audience and they're like laughing at him telling this story. I'm like, are you okay? Like he's imagining there's people.
He loves making up little stories, and we're going to get more into that later, but his favorite thing is to make up little stories.
He's like living in a little fantasy world he's creating for himself here.
He talks about how occasionally he will have emotions that distract him from his consciousness, but he says that normally the emotions pass and then afterwards he loathes himself for making up the emotion, where it's basically like he was angry and now he's not angry. So that means he was never really angry. He just made up the thought of being angry as a form of entertainment. Like,
emotions aren't even real. Like, you're just making yourself feel that way. Like,
I'm so sorry that you've put yourself in this position to feel in that way. He also alludes to some of the stuff that's going to happen later on in the book, where he talks about how he'll sometimes invent things out of boredom in order to enrich his life. Yeah, so he had nothing going on, and so he chose to be offended by someone, or he chose to fall in love with someone just to add something to the monotony of his life. He then spends a little bit of time defending himself, where he's like, whoa, 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 I think that you probably feel that up until this point, I've just been trying to justify that I'm actually lazy, and I don't do anything because I'm lazy. But he says, no, no, no. Because if I was lazy, I would be happy. And my life sucks, man. So clearly I'm not lazy, because if I was lazy, I'd be laying on a beach somewhere, drinking and thinking about everything that's beautiful. But instead, I'm in a tunnel underground. I'm in your floorboards, and I'm really, really sad. Then we start getting more direct about what it is that Dostoevsky's trying to criticize in this book, where the man from underground starts criticizing popular progressive ideas, which at this time period, it was a really common concept in philosophy, like this concept of utilitarianism, where the idea was if every man was well educated, they would then behave rationally. And if every man behaved rationally, it would fix all of the problems in the world. So, like, everything that is wrong in the world, like doing crimes or gambling or falling in love with the wrong person, all of those things are obviously opposed to the self-interest of the person who is doing them. And so if you want to correct them, you just have to make people smarter, and then they'll stop doing things that are hurting them, saying that it's basically it's not to their advantage to do those things, and therefore society would become a utopia when everyone is striving to follow their own advantage. The man from Underground says that this is bullshit. this is a whole crock of shit, and says that there's one thing that they're not considering when it comes to a person's advantage, and that is that the ultimate advantage is being able to act on your own free will, saying that people would just get bored living in a society that is relegated and regimented through charts and tables about what it is that is good for them and what it is that they're supposed to want. And so some people would start acting out of their own self-interest just to avoid doing what they're told.
Mm-hmm.
He... Again, we start doing a little bit more straw manning, where he comes up with a counter argument from his hypothetical audience saying, well, yeah, but science can also explain free will using statistics. And he says, what a fool you are for thinking that that's true. Actually, if you try to give a man specific rules within which to cage his free will, he'll act even more erratically to prove that you don't know what you're talking about. That basically every man is going to always reject any type of structure that is placed on him that should potentially confine his ability to act freely.
He's like, no, man will literally go insane. Man will lose it just to prove that every will. Man will be institutionalized.
Men will literally go crazy instead of living in a utopia.
Don't I know it?
He then says, okay, so actually everything that I've said so far is really just kind of a bitter joke. Like, this all, it's so funny how all of this plays out and works into one another, and starts talking about how there's like inherent contradictions within men, where a man, and I guess I should be clear here, whenever he's talking about man, he's talking about like mankind as a whole, not specifically the men of society. It's like mankind, although I will say it feels more targeted towards men of society than the women of society, particularly considering when it was written. But men, he says, have a desire to both create and destroy, but have little desire in seeing their creative process fulfilled. They actually just want to participate in the creative process, because then once you've created something, the process ends and then you have nothing left to accomplish. And so he hypothesizes that even if you could create a purely reasonable society that solved all the world's problems, everyone would go crazy because they had nothing left to do. But on the other hand, if instead of a reasonable society, you lived in a purely conscious society, nothing would ever get done, but at least you could find some entertainment in occasionally whipping yourselves with the problems that are around you. Now is when we get into talking about the idea of the Crystal Palace, which I'm going to come back to this a lot in the context episode, but essentially, it was a building built for a World's Fair back in the 1850s that's entirely made out of glass and steel, and was seen to be a beacon of a utopian and progressive future. And the man talks about how he hates the building because he can't stick his tongue out at it, which it's a whole thing, but basically he wants to stick his tongue out at the idea that is represented by the building and is unable to stick his tongue out at an idea. And so he's bummed out about that. It talks about how he wishes he could use it as a chicken coop, but then he wouldn't call it a palace anymore. And then he backtracks and is like, well, actually, wait a second. I think maybe I do have a desire for beautiful things like crystal palaces, but it makes him feel bad to have lofty desires, and so he wishes that he didn't. And then part one ends with us really putting the pedal to the metal on the idea of an unreliable narrator in this one, where he just says, actually, everything that I've said so far, I didn't mean. It was something that I maybe believed when I was writing it, but I don't believe it anymore. All of it was really stupid. And he then has this long, drawn-out monologue that he hypothesizes the readers are having at this point, where they're saying, well, why did you write all of this? Like, what was the point of it? How can you be so inconsistent in your beliefs? How can you not stick to any of your convictions like this? And he, after going through this whole monologue, he ends it by just saying, like, yeah, but guess what? I also just made up everything that you just said to me because you're not real. So joke's on you. I just made you look stupid because you thought you were real. And he then says that he doesn't have any intention of ever publishing the notes. They were just a prompt to get him to start writing. And then he mentions the fact that it's snowing outside and says that the snow reminds him of an episode from his past. And so that is when he starts to recount his memory. And that's why we get the title of part two, Apropos of the Snow. Now, we get into this start of part two, and this is when we actually start to get a narrative. So it'll be a little bit more clear cut of what's happening now. This is the majority of the book now that we've gotten all of the heady philosophical debates out of the way. But this part is still really satirical, which again, you're going to have to come back next week to hear about what it is that it's satirizing. But we're back
that
in time.
The first part was like, sorry, it's so short, but it was just really heavy. Like, I was just like, whoa.
Yeah, he's dealing with a lot of like concepts that if you're not familiar with them, it seems a little bit out of left field. But I will say, still really funny. It's just got a really good
I found it really funny.
Tone to it. It's really fun to mm-hmm. read, even if you don't have the context for it, which Sydney doesn't, but I do. We're back in time now. The narrator, who remains unnamed for the entire book, is 24 years old and he's working as a civil servant. He's unhappy with his life, surprise, surprise, and he's consistently oscillating between feeling wildly superior to everyone around him all the time and then also intensely inferior to everyone around him all the time, which gives him very little time in the middle ground where he's actually able to talk to people with any type of competency. And so he's just really lonely all the time.
Yeah.
Which results in him going to a lot of like seedier places and just getting drunk in dirty bars and stuff just to try and find some sort of a connection without being around the people who would recognize him and think ill of him for attempting to make friends. One night while he's in the bar, he sees some people get into a fight, and one of the guys gets thrown through the bar window as a result of the fight. And he goes, damn, I'd love to take part in something like that. And like, it's really like the deep depression of loneliness where you just need somebody to touch you in any way. And he's like, man, I bet it would feel so good for somebody to throw me through a window.
I want to be assaulted physically just to feel something.
So he decides that he's going to go out of his way to try and get into a fight. He goes to intentionally bump into an officer but then chickens out at the last second, and the guy just walks past him without acknowledging that he almost bumped into him or excusing himself or anything, which results in the underground man becoming obsessed with getting revenge on this guy for a perceived slight that did not actually happen. He starts plotting how he's going to intentionally bump into this guy in the future and how he's going to make him feel ashamed of not recognizing him before. So he starts taking out loans and buying nice clothes so that he's going to look like the equal to the officer. Eventually works up the courage, bumps into him again, but the officer still does not acknowledge him at all, even though they have bumped into one another. At first, he's like, wow, I really showed him that I'm his equal by neither of us reacting to the fact that we bumped into one another. And then 3 days later, he's in a depressive spiral saying, oh my god, why didn't I stand up for myself? Oh my god. So this puts him into a spiral where he is going to seedy places and also daydreaming about how much of a literary hero he is. He's the hero of his own story. He starts to feel the need for social interaction, which typically every Tuesday he goes to a coworker's house and has tea. And he is so shy the whole time that he never actually talks, but it still lets him leave and feel like he had social interaction. So it's a plus. But he doesn't want to wait until Tuesday, so instead he goes to an old classmate's house, whose name is Semenov. When he gets there, there's two other former classmates who are there, and the three of them are planning a going away party for a fourth former classmate named Zverkov. It just so happens that the underground man hates Zverkov's guts. Because when they were in school together, Zverkov was really, really popular and also kind of a dick. Like, I think that it's justified that the narrator hates this guy, although I am with the caveat of this guy's an unreliable narrator. I don't know if this is true or not. But apparently, throughout school, the guy's constantly talking about how when he gets older and grows up, he's going to win so many duels. Like, you don't even know how many duels this guy's going to win. And also, he's the heir to a large estate, which in that time period, it was the law of the land, although not always practiced, that if basically a serf who lives on your estate gets married, the lord of the estate is allowed to have sex with that serf on her wedding night before her husband is allowed to. And apparently Zverkov spent a lot of time in school talking about how he was going to really take advantage of that law and have sex with so many girls on their wedding night before their husband could. Which, again, I don't know if it actually happened. He's an unreliable narrator. If it did, that's fucked up and we hate Zverkov.
Weird behavior, Zverkov.
But everyone is like, let's go, we're gonna have dinner. The man ends up insisting that he gets to be a part of the dinner, even though he hates Zverkov and doesn't actually want to go. Claims that he will pay for the dinner in order to get them to agree to let him to come, even though he does not have the money to pay for dinner. Everyone finally accepts. They all find excuses to leave for the night. He has to go home alone. Instantly is regretting because he's like, none of them want me to be there, and also I don't want to be there, but now there's nothing I can do. There was nothing I could have done at all during that situation to prevent having to go and pay for something I can't afford. He mopes about it for a day, ends up going, gets to dinner 25 minutes late, but is still the first person to get there because he finds out that Semenov changed the time for the dinner without telling him. And so he just waits there for an hour until everybody else shows up, gets instantly awkward, and he has a minor meltdown where he's basically just shouting about how, I'm not embarrassed! I'm not embarrassed about being here! I'm not dressed very well, but I'm not embarrassed about it! And he then spends most of the dinner just getting drunk and not talking, makes an offensive speech towards Zverkov, and challenges somebody to a duel, but everybody just laughs him off because he's drunk, obviously. Goes back to just being silent, but inwardly he's constantly thinking, like, God, how can I make them like me? God, I really wish that they would all just like me. It should be noted, everyone else is trying to make this a pleasant dinner. Like, they're all just laughing and having a good time, and they're occasionally, like, asking him questions and stuff to try and engage him in the dinner, but he spends the whole time just pacing against the back wall, and anytime somebody addresses him, he just goes, ha! And then keeps pacing, just refuses to talk to anybody.
So he has social anxiety as well as...
Oh, yeah.
A lot of other things.
Eventually, the men starts to go to leave, and he begs for their forgiveness, and then also begs his friend Semenov for some money so that he can go with them to the after party that's going to happen at a brothel that they're all heading to. He gets given the money. Everybody leaves. He starts going on his own to also go to the brothel, and he thinks to himself, by the end of the night, they all will either beg for my friendship or I'm going to slap Zverkov in the face. He then spends the whole trip fantasizing about what's really going to happen when he gets to the brothel. He doesn't want to go. He knows no one wants him there, but he's like, this is my destiny. I can't avoid my destiny. I must go to the brothel and make a huge scene. He gets there. Everyone else has already gone off with various prostitutes, and so he's alone in the parlor until a young prostitute named Liza comes out and takes him in to have sex. He wakes up after having sex and immediately feels a lot of guilt about having sex without being in love. So he starts questioning Liza about her history, and she's not really being forthright about what's going on. He gives her a long speech about how actually it's incredibly immoral to be a prostitute, and every prostitute ends up living a really bad life and then dying from consumption.
It's what every prostitute wants to hear.
He sees that this is having an effect on her and is like, wow, I love having an effect on this woman. And so he keeps talking, and he gives this long speech about how beautiful and redeeming marriage and family can be, then pivots hard again and starts saying, hey, maybe if you weren't a prostitute, I would be in love with you, but that's impossible because you're a prostitute, and that means you're not worthy of any respect. She ends up crying, at which point he feels bad, and so he gives her his address and says, come and see me sometime, gotta go, bye. Just runs out. The next day, he's super ashamed and horrified by all of the behaviors that he's had towards Liza and towards his friends, so he writes a letter to his former classmates seeking their forgiveness, and he feels so good about this letter. He's like, God, I'm so good at writing letters that make me sound offhanded and yet repentant at the same time. I'm so smart. Then he spends the day both dreading and hoping for Liza to eventually come so that he can save her from prostitution and make her fall in love with him. He gets into an argument with his servant, and that's exactly the point when Liza shows up, and he's in the parlor arguing with his servant. Liza comes into the parlor, and the narrator runs out of the room to his bedroom so that his servant can come to the bedroom and say, you have a visitor? Instantly, he jumps back into yelling at Liza, saying, I never had any intention of saving you from prostitution. I can't believe what a fool you were for actually coming here. And he says that the whole thing was just because it made him feel good to exert power over her and make her feel humiliated. At first, Liza is obviously really upset by what's going on. But as the speech continues, she begins to realize, oh, this guy is wildly lonely and deeply broken. And so she feels like a really intense pity for him. And eventually when he stops yelling, she just like holds him and they cry together. This is a really funny scene because it's really deeply emotional. It's a really cathartic experience. But then after he's finished crying, he's like, fuck, what do I do now? She's just holding me. How do I make it to where she's not holding me? This is going to be so awkward for her to stop holding me.
Gosh.
And so he just gets up and charges out of the room. And he starts pacing outside, looking through a crack between some room partitions at her, just kind of waiting for him to come back. And he's thinking to himself of how he's actually incapable of love because he views love only as a means by which you can have the right to tyrannize someone else at any point in their life. Liza gets up, goes to leave, and as she's leaving, he hands her money in an attempt to humiliate her further. And this is one where, even in the moment, he's thinking to himself, I don't want to be doing this, but it seems like something that the hero of a book would do, so I'm going to do it. He then, after she leaves, attempts to run after her to beg her forgiveness. He's unable to catch up with her and find her, but he thinks to himself, maybe what I did was actually good and correct because this will be the spark that makes her now live a more fulfilling life than she would have otherwise. He then returns from the flashback and almost instantly is like, I think maybe I made some mistakes in my life. I don't know that for a fact, but it's possible that I made some mistakes. And then starts describing the notes that he's writing as a form of corrective punishment, where he's forcing himself to recollect how he was a bad person. He then says, like, I don't know why anyone would ever read this, because my antisocial life underground is uninteresting, and actually, I think maybe I'm an anti-hero and not the hero of my story. He then says, actually, if you are reading this, my fictional future audience, I hope that you recognize that all of the desires and impulses that exist within me also exist within you. The only difference between us is that I'm willing to carry those impulses to the furthest possible extent, whereas you're not willing to go that far. Dostoevsky then steps in for another note where he says, the notes keep going after this, like he actually wrote a lot of shit, but this seemed like the best place to stop, so I'm gonna stop here. And that's how the novella ends.
Yeah.
So
it's like, all right, this guy wrote a lot, but that was enough. We need to hear more.
Like I said, I'll go over a lot of the context behind this in next week's episode, because there's some stuff that I'll go a little bit further into when it comes to, like, what are the actual utilitarian ideals that it is that Dostoevsky's trying to critique. But also, this book was basically written in response to another book, and I'm going to tell you all about that other book next week, because it's basically like this book is borderline a parody of another book that had come out just a couple of years earlier, which, if you're not familiar with that book, it makes this one a lot less straightforward to see as, oh, you're making fun of this specific guy. But that'll be it for this week. Did you have anything that you wanted to shout out or point at from a plot synopsis standpoint?
No, I don't think so. I did find it, like, really funny. I was like, who is this guy? And it was, I was, like, fluctuating between being like, aw, and, like, sympathizing with him, being like, oh, I get that, and then being like, oh.
It's a really complex and interesting character, where it is very much like, this guy's life sucks, but so much of the reason why his life sucks is his own fault. And yeah, it's like, man, I feel bad for your life being that way, and also I feel bad that you are the kind of person that can't help but put yourself in these situations, but wow, it really is tough for me to sympathize with you when you're making these kinds of decisions every single day of your life, which is the point. That's the whole point of the book. You're not supposed to necessarily like this guy or think you should be like him. He's supposed to be a little bit slimy. But before we go, we are going to play a wonderful game called Have They Read It, in which the two of us speculate wildly as to whether or not any notable figures have read this specific book. This is a tough one because of how old it is. So that really opens up the possibility for, like, if someone hasn't read it, it's not because they haven't had time to get around to it yet. I am going to start with... I'm going to start with a guy who I think, if Notes from Underground were made into a movie, this guy would probably be heavily considered to play the old version of the unnamed narrator, because I think that he would really fit well in a role of little guy living under the floorboards. Do you think Willem Dafoe has read Notes from Underground?
I know nothing about his, like, reading habits, but I could definitely see him in the role. And he does, like, a range of films that aren't all mainstream.
Yeah. He's definitely moved more into artsy films since his stint with Spider-Man.
But I don't know that he's, like... I feel like he probably, like, does a lot of preparation for the roles he plays. But I don't know if he's just, like, reading Dostoevsky, like...
Okay.
In his free time. I don't know. But I agree with you. Okay, so I was thinking of an actor who has played a character by another Russian author... From a play by another Russian author.
Okay.
Chekhov's Vanya. Do you think Andrew Scott has read?
Oh man, notes from... I think so. I personally feel like Willem Dafoe is educated enough and, like, interesting enough as a person that I think he would have read this. And I feel very similarly about Andrew Scott, where I feel like, and maybe this is just my personal bias, because I am a big fan of Andrew Scott, but I feel like he would be someone who would be really interesting to have a conversation with, because he gives me the vibes of somebody who is well-read and, like, partakes in a wide array of art. And so I'm going to say yes, I think Andrew Scott has read Notes from Underground. Maybe once. So, Fyodor Dostoevsky is maybe the most literarily respected satirist that there's ever been. Like, he's not necessarily the most famous satirist of all time, because I don't think that many people who are, like, common public know that a lot of his work is satirical. But as far as, like, the quality of his work literarily, I think that he's probably up there as, like, the most respected satirist that there's ever been. So I'm thinking of someone who is very well known for being satirical, but is a potential in is satirical in a different way that makes him a lot more controversial literarily. So it's still satire, but different vein of Dostoevsky. Do you think author of Choke and Fight Club, Chuck Palahniuk, has read Notes from Underground?
Maybe. I'd like to think that, like, authors specifically, different, like, type of satire, yeah, but, like, within a genre or a broader, like, writing style, read other satire of diverse types to kind of... So yeah, maybe.
I mean, I know that there are a lot of satirists who, like, I feel like if you're involved in satire, then you are aware that Dostoevsky and a lot of other, like, great Russian mm-hmm. authors are satirical writers. And so I think that you would pull from that. Like, I'm thinking of George Saunders is a satirical author that mm-hmm. we have not talked about yet on the podcast, but we definitely will. He's got a couple of books that I really enjoy, a couple of short stories that I think we should talk about. But he wrote a whole book called A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, where he breaks down Russian authors. And so clearly he pulls inspiration from that source. And so, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if anybody who is currently writing satire has read all of the, like, Russian great works.
Mm-hmm. Okay, my last one is just, like, jumping off of. Oh my gosh, wait, I'll... Brief intermission. I saw this TikTok, and this guy was saying that, like, he was in class, and you say, like, let me jump off of, let me bounce off of that, whatever. But he accidentally said, let me bounce on that point. And everyone, like, laughed, and they were like, they're like, what, you're bouncing on the point? Anyways, but jumping off of Andrew Scott, another Irish actor who's been in a film with him, Paul Mescal. Do you think Paul Mescal?
No. I don't know if this is true or not. So first of all, I think Paul Mescal is younger than Andrew Scott, and so he has less, mm-hmm. he has had less of an opportunity to read these kinds of books than Andrew Scott has. And also, I feel like Paul Mescal maybe puts forward more of an air of being literary than Andrew Scott does, where I think that Andrew Scott has the vibe of somebody who reads a lot because I think he actually just reads a lot. I think Paul Mescal likes seeming like he reads a lot, and I don't know if he does or not. That's, like, not, if you're listening, Paul, I'm not saying you don't, you very well could. I just don't know if you would have read this.
He's definitely read a former Satire Fire feature, Normal People, because he was in it. Well, I mean, I would hope. I don't know.
You would think.
I just assume that when people act in a movie or show adaptation of a book, that they read the book. That might not be true.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's true. Like, Millie Bobby Brown, she's got her start in Stranger Things and has then gone on to do, like, Enola Holmes and a bunch of other stuff. Mm-hmm. Openly on record of hates watching movies. Like, she just doesn't watch movies. She's an actor, and she does not watch movies. And so I just think that if there are actors out there who don't watch movies, there's gotta be way more actors out there who don't read.
Yeah. It just feels like it's, like, almost part of your job, but maybe it's not. Maybe you just have to read the script. I don't know. I just feel like I would want to know, like, what was inspiring the character that I say as someone who's not an actor, but, like...
Yeah. If you were, though. Inspiring.
If I was. Here's how I would do it. Let me tell you how to do your job.
But that is going to do it for us for this week. Like I said, be sure to come back next week when we're going to be talking about the historical context behind this book, learning a little bit about Dostoevsky, learning a lot about the book that he is making fun of. And then the week after that, come back again, we'll be doing an analysis of the book. I don't know how obvious it is what our feelings about the book are, but I mean, we've already checked off one of our bookmarks. Clearly it's funny, so we already know that that's the case. But thank you so much for listening this week. We hope that you are able to come back again next week. We hope that between now and then you can tell a friend about the show, where we always are talking about satire. It's always nice to get more listeners because folks are telling their friends about us. Our intro and outro are remixes of the song 48 by Culla. And Sydney, if folks want to chat with us or see what we're up to between this week and next week, where can they find us?
We are on Instagram at the Satire Fire Pod, P-O-D. And we are on TikTok, Blue Sky, and YouTube at The Satire Fire. You can find us there. Like Samuel said, follow, like, subscribe, comment, send us a direct message if you don't want to comment publicly. Don't be crazy, though. we appreciate whatever engagement you want to give us. Also, you know, the holidays are coming up. If you celebrate a holiday, that's exciting. If you want to celebrate us, give us 5 stars. that's the present I want this holiday season.
Absolutely. That's the best way to support our show is listening to our show and telling other people to listen to our show. But
that's all I want for Christmas.
That'll do it for us for this week. This has been the Satire Fire, and don't forget to support your local library. I am Samuel.
I'm Sydney.
Bye.
Bye. Going back into my underground hole.
I've just about come to the end of the road. Here, I've just about lost patience with you people. You get your ass out into the mountains or someplace or hide in there and watch that damn tube. But if not, fuck it. I'm done. In fact, my sermon.